you, Chief Justice. May it please the court, I am Assistant Attorney General Jeffrey Castle, appearing today on behalf of the state of Wisconsin. The issue in this case involves the interpretation and application of a provision of Section 968.20, which governs the disposition of property seized by law enforcement officers, whether with or without a search warrant. Under Section 968.20, a person whose property has been seized by the police has a right to the return of that property if the property is not contraband and if the property is no longer needed as evidence. However, subsection 1MB of Section 968.20 provides an important exception to that rule for dangerous weapons. If the seized property is a dangerous weapon, the statute says, the property shall not be returned to any person who committed a crime involving the use of the dangerous weapon. The specific question for this court is whether the crime of carrying a concealed weapon is, in the language of subsection 1MB, a crime involving the use of a dangerous weapon. As the Court of Appeals correctly noted, however, the court's answer to that question will also affect the disposition of weapons involved in other crimes. Crimes such as going armed in a public setting, going armed in a tavern, and the possession of a gun in a school zone. The relevant facts of this case are few and undisputed. On November 14, 1998, defendant Carlos Perez went armed, very well armed, in the city of Mequon when he drove his van with a loaded .45 caliber semi-automatic pistol on the floor of the van between the front seats. He also had a loaded shotgun and an unloaded rifle on the floor of the vehicle. Those guns were discovered by a City of Mequon police officer who was dispatched to assist Perez, who had gotten stuck in a ditch while attempting to make a U-turn. Perez was charged with carrying a concealed weapon, and the Mequon police seized the firearms, along with several knives, some ammunition, and several other items found in the van. After he was convicted and sentenced following a plea of no contest to the concealed weapons charge, Perez filed a motion under 968.20 seeking return of the firearms. Both the trial court and the Court of Appeals, with one judge dissenting, agreed with Perez that he had not used his weapons to commit a crime, and that he was therefore entitled to the return of those weapons. The Court of Appeals, in its decision, looked to a dictionary definition of use to support its conclusion that Perez had not used his guns in the commission of a crime. The state believes that under the very definition of use employed by the Court of Appeals, Perez did use his guns to commit the crime of carrying a concealed weapon.
Carrying a concealed weapon is a possessory crime, right?
Yes, in the sense that it is enough to support a conviction that a person knowingly be in possession of a weapon that is concealed.
So your position is possession equals use?
For the purposes of 968.20. Well, let me explain first why I think even under a Court of Appeals definition of use, we can conclude that it was a use. But I'd like to argue, and my main argument, is that we need to look beyond the dictionary definition. The dictionary definition that the Court of Appeals used, and there are many dictionary definitions of use, but the Court of Appeals looked to a Webster's dictionary and said, well, that definition requires that the gun or an item be put into action or service, or to apply to advantage, or to carry out a purpose or action by means of. I believe that Perez used his weapons in that third sense, carrying out an action by means of. He carried out the action of going armed with a concealed weapon by means of the three guns that were found in his van. Indeed, the Court of Appeals believed that the dictionary definition of use required that the firearm had to be part of the crime. That was the term the Court of Appeals used. After reviewing the dictionary definitions, it said These definitions require that the weapon be part of the crime. Forensic guns were certainly part of the crime of carrying concealed weapons. There were no guns, there was no crime. But the state believes the better answer to this question of statutory interpretation is found not by picking and choosing among the many possible dictionary definitions of use, some of which have a more active component, clearly, than others do.
So, counsel, so how was this used? My question, how was this used in commission of crime? It was used because it didn't have a case around it. Is that correct? Say, hypothetically, you could have uncased guns in the trunk, and this would be carrying a concealed weapon.
Well, to be carrying a concealed weapon, it's got to be within reach.
Okay, so that the guns in the back, these were, you're talking about the one gun, which was the .45. What about the long guns, the .30-06 and the shotgun?
We have very little factual information about where precisely these were.
Would this depend on the facts? So in other words, a judge, and I guess I'm looking at using his or her discretion, would they be able to say that if there was an uncased gun in the back seat of a car, that then under your definition, if that's, quote, within reach, that that is a, quote, concealed weapon?
Yes, and there's case law that says if it is within reach in the car, that is, and it's hidden from ordinary observation, that's correct. Now, I guess I want to emphasize, we have a criminal complaint that describes...
Just a second. Because Justice Wilcox's question prompted one in my mind. We all know that trial judges have discretion.
Of course,
right? And say the admissibility. So they possess discretion, right? They have it, they possess it. When they use that discretion, are they still possessing it? I mean, isn't there a difference between saying a trial judge possesses discretion and then the actual use of discretion? In one instance, it's lying dormant, in the other instance, it's being used. Why isn't that the same thing here?
And that's why I think we need to look at what the legislature was trying to accomplish.
So you think it's ambiguous, so we're going to look at
it? I think it's ambiguous.
Okay.
Because, and the example I used in my brief was one from the U.S. Supreme Court as it was trying to interpret what use means.
Does it make any difference following up Justice Babbage? I mean, he talked... use can be the verb or the noun. He used discretion, active. A judge has available the use of discretion, noun. The noun is broader. The noun does not, it's not a verb, it's not an action, it's not to employ, it's not to use. Does that make a difference?
I don't think so, because I think the verb sense really certainly creeps up on the broadest sense of the noun.
How is it used in this statute? Is a verb or a noun?
The precise language is
involving
the use of, which would be a verb.
Involving the use of is a noun.
Let's parse it together then.
I might be wrong.
Students in the audience probably know that.
Yeah,
I think the use of...
Involving the use of.
It's probably a noun, and a verb is, he used discretion.
Right.
A judge has a panoply of available devices, including the use of discretion.
Yeah. I guess I'd be hard-pressed to argue we'd have a different outcome in the case if the statute said return to a defendant who used the gun in the commission of a crime.
No, I think you would have. I think it's very different. That's why I erase it.
Okay, well, I don't want to be arguing against myself. but I guess...
Why can't you substitute possession for use in that term,
okay,
in that line? If a seized property is a dangerous weapon or ammunition, the property shall not be returned to any person who committed the crime involving the possession of a dangerous weapon or the ammunition. I think that it would then cover everything it now covers. That is, it would cover armed robbery, which is a possession with the gun. You don't necessarily have to wave it around or point it, right? I did not run through the statutes with a computer to see where else a weapon, but if this is a noun, which I think it is, both in Justice Bradley's and Justice Babbage's discussion, you could substitute the word possession for use. The judge uses discretion. The other one was has discretion, which means possession. We're trying to help you, Mr.
Kessler. I'm gratefully accepting your help. And I agree, as I sit here and think about it, it is used as a noun, and, with apologies to my 11th grade English teacher.
But what you're really trying to say here is, regardless of what grammatically or dictionary usage, just another word, that the public policy underlying the statute tells us something else.
And the public policy as expressed in the legislative intent, that's right. And that, if we look at how this statute came about, there was a statute on the books for about 20 years that actually had language very similar to this. And I didn't discuss that prior statute in my brief, even though it's discussed in the Court of Appeals decision in Williams, because that statute went away for about a period of 15 years. And in reviewing the legislative history of that prior statute, which I believe was 963.04, I found absolutely nothing to explain it, what it means there are no cases. That statute, which talked about weapons used in the commission of a crime becoming the property of the state crime lab, with the 1969 revision of the statute and the enactment of section 968.20, the legislature eliminated that provision, and we were left with, for many years, with nothing dealing with the treatment of guns used in a crime. Then, in 1984, we have the current statute crafted, and the Legislative Reference Bureau explains what it means, and what the Legislative Reference Bureau said was, this proposal revises the treatment of seized firearms or ammunition. If the person committing a crime with a firearm commits a crime, if the person committed a crime with a firearm or ammunition, the firearm or ammunition may not be returned to him or her. So that's what we think the proper test is. Did the person commit a crime with a firearm? I think, as applied in this circumstance to carrying a concealed weapon, you can't commit that crime without a firearm.
You're reading with a firearm as meaning possessing.
How I would read it is, if a firearm is an element of the crime that is either charged or could have charged, and I guess I'll explain my could have reasoning in a bit, or as part of a penalty enhancer for the dangerous weapon, I think it is satisfied. So any crime where it's either part of the elements of the crime charged or could have been charged, or there's the sufficient nexus to satisfy under the penalty enhancer. The reason I say could have been charged or convicted is for several reasons. One, I look to a case like this court's decision last year in Jones v. State involving cash that was contraband, and the court held that it was contraband because it was found in connection with some drug paraphernalia. The drug paraphernalia charges were ultimately dismissed. So the defendant was never convicted of being of any charge which by itself the money was associated with. Nevertheless, the court said, in circumstances like that, the state could nevertheless attempt to prove by the greater weight of credible evidence that the cash was contraband by virtue of its association with the drug paraphernalia, and in fact the court concluded that there was sufficient evidence.
I'm familiar with the Jones case, but isn't that the point here of what the facts were in the Jones case as compared to what the facts are here, that this person, if we want to talk about, because Jones emphasized the factual basis upon why that was contraband here, and the trial judge in analyzing this looks at this person had a license to carry these weapons in the state of Florida and came to the state of Wisconsin. Many states allow you to have an uncased loaded weapon in the car. I mean, in South Dakota, North Dakota, Colorado, Idaho, in any event. My question is this. This is what the judge was looking at when apparently he defined the use or looked at the question of use, and that seems to be what the Court of Appeals also was talking about.
And I think
when they distinguished right. Jones' case.
And I think when the defendant has actually been convicted of a crime in which the gun is an element or the penalty and answer was implied, I think that answers the question. I think the examination of the facts would have to take place really only where there was no conviction. So let me give you another example. A defendant commits a sexual assault by threatening the use of a gun and is charged with first-degree sexual assault which involves the threat of use of a dangerous weapon. But let's imagine there's a plea agreement and it's pled down to second-degree sexual assault by threat of force or violence. So no longer is the weapon an element of the crime. I think in those circumstances, the state could still say the gun is not subject to return and prove that the gun was involved in that sexual assault. As I say that, I realize it's not a perfect example because the person has just been convicted of a felony, so would not be entitled to a return regardless of sub 1 and B. So we can make it, let's make the crime involving a weapon.
Misdemeanor battery.
Make it a misdemeanor battery, exactly.
Domestic violence, misdemeanor battery. Very common situation.
And there was a gun involved, but the resolution is a misdemeanor battery. No weapons enhancer, simple misdemeanor battery. I think in cases like that, the burden would then be on the state to prove under the specific facts of the case that there was a gun involved in the commission of that crime.
But not if we tie the operation of the statute to the elements of the offense, because the elements of a misdemeanor battery or misdemeanor disorderly
right.
conduct do not include the use or possession of a weapon.
That's right. I'm saying in cases, there are two ways I think the state could meet its burden under sub 1M. One is by showing the defendant was convicted of an offense in which the weapon was an element or the penalty enhancer was actually applied. If it was not, then I think the state should still have the opportunity to show that the weapon was involved in the commission of the crime.
Well, but that's not the case before us.
That's correct.
The case before us, an element is having a gun.
That's correct.
It seems to me you might have a disagreement about whether a crime, whether involving the use of the dangerous weapon refers to the crime of conviction and the elements thereof, or whether involving the use of a dangerous weapon refers to the facts of the crime, or the facts of the offense, whether or not that one was charged. We don't have to deal with that. In this case, we have a crime in which the element is a weapon, and all we have to do is decide what use means.
That's right. The reason I brought up going beyond the element is a concern that if the court, because the weapon is an element in this case, were to state the test strictly in terms of an element, then we might have a lot of crimes because of the way they are ultimately resolved appear not to fall within the subsection.
Seems to me your main argument should be like the amicus brief that says, look, these guys have dangerous weapons. They're running around with guns. Maybe it was lawful in Florida. It's not lawful in Wisconsin. Maybe it's okay in South Dakota. It's not okay here. Maybe he's a really good guy and his aim in life is hunting, which is lawful in Wisconsin. But under the statute, you should take away the gun. Because otherwise, when you get to armed robbery with it, there is possession of the gun, but not actual, when I talk now, use, meaning in the verb sense of active application of the gun. You ought to broadly read the statute to get rid of dangerous weapons on the street. That's what Milwaukee is saying.
And I absolutely agree with him.
Could I ask, there were three weapons involved here. There was a handgun that was found between the seats that was loaded and uncased.
Correct.
There was a shotgun that was loaded and uncased. And there was an unloaded cased rifle.
Correct.
If the unloaded cased rifle on the floor of the van had been the only weapon, could Mr. Perez have been convicted of carrying a concealed weapon?
I think if it were in reach, probably yes. Depending on, I'm not sure whether if the case were locked. For example, there is a case that says handgun in the glove compartment, which is in a container. It's not a case, but it's in the compartment. If that's in reach, that is carrying a concealed weapon.
Why do you argue that the statute is ambiguous?
Because I think a reasonable person could argue that use means some active, more active use. And I don't think, given the way that the courts below have looked at it, I think a reasonable person, it would be wrong, I believe, but I think it's not an unreasonable argument to this thing, say you. So I think, and its use is really so varies depending on the context, that it's one of those words that I think begs a look at the legislative history to find out what the legislature was intending. And I think Chief Justice Abrahamson put her finger on what the public policy.
Well, let me ask this. If the court were to conclude that the statute were ambiguous, is there some reason why the statute should not be strictly construed, narrowly construed?
I don't think it's a penal statute in the sense it doesn't define the crime. We are looking at a remedy here, really. So I think for that reason, even though it is in the criminal code, we're talking about a proceeding in effect against the weapons to keep them from being returned.
This is a forfeiture of property, isn't it?
Well, you know, strictly speaking, in effect it is. There is a separate forfeiture statute which requires an action by the state, and there is an order, I assume, forfeiting it. This is denominated return of property. It provides a remedy to someone who wants return of property, to someone who asks for it and the return is denied for all practical purposes. It operates as a forfeiture. If the court has no further questions, I will thank you.
Well, what kind of hearing do you get on this, if any?
Well, the
968.20 talks about a hearing, right?
Yeah, it's my understanding that in some locales, there are actually, these motions are brought even as a separate action. In this case, it was done as a motion within the criminal proceeding.
The motion by the defendant saying, I want my guns back. Right?
Correct. So I don't think the statute makes it clear whether which proceeding it has to be. But the court has suggested that this proceeds like any other motion hearing, I think. Here, the defendant came forth with proof in the form of an affidavit that he was entitled to, that he owned the guns. That wasn't disputed. And so I think then the burden shifts to the state to demonstrate that they were either items of contraband, as in Jones, or used in the commission of a crime, which burden would be satisfied if it were an element or a penalty enhancer. I see my time's up.
Thank you, Mr. Castle. Mr. Stansberry, representing Carlos Perez. I'm sorry, did you send me a question? So, go ahead.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Doug Stansberry. I'm a lawyer with the law firm of Levy & Levy in Cedarburg, and I represent Carlos Perez. Madam Chief Justice, just to quickly address your issue with respect to the procedure, you actually raise a fairly interesting point. I can tell you that in Ozaukee County, a different branch than the branch at issue in this case holds the position that it must be a separate proceeding to bring an I-6820 procedure. And in fact, I have a case pending before that judge that's waiting for the outcome of this decision to see if the procedural question might be answered. In the case at hand...
see it raised in the case at hand. Did I miss it?
It is not raised.
So what? The only issue before us, it's not whether you hold it inside the criminal case or you have a special proceeding. The only issue before us is whether your client committed a crime involving the use of the dangerous weapon or the ammunition. Is that right?
I believe that's correct. And I look at it, first of all, by asking the question, in every case of CCW, carrying the concealed weapon, does that mean that a defendant actively employed the use of a weapon? And I think that the Walls Court already answered that decision and said, or answered that question and said, no, that mere possession is enough to sustain a conviction under CCW. In fact, the Walls Court defined the elements of the crime when the question was mere possession, and that was certainly whether or not the defendant knew of its presence of the weapon, and in this case, Mr. Perez did. The remaining two questions are, was it within the defendant's reach, and was it hidden from ordinary view? Mr. Perez conceded those elements by entering his no-contest plea to being a party to the crime of CCW in this case, with the specific reservation of his right to litigate the 96820 issue.
Counsel, is there someone else? Counsel, I want to get you, you used the phrase, actively employed the use of a weapon. And again, I'm getting back to this verb and noun sort of thing, because that was I found that a very interesting turn of the phrase, because employ, according to these definitions, means to use. So actively used the use of a weapon is essentially what you're saying. But the lower courts, in looking at this statute and focusing on the word use, did they follow the definition of the word as a verb or as a noun?
Judge Sweetlick, I believe, used it in the sense that it was a verb. In my moving papers to the trial court, I included the dictionary definition at that level, and in the judge's questioning of the district attorney in that proceeding, he made the distinction between using the weapon, actively using the weapon, and merely possessing the weapon. The Court of Appeals in its decision, and the majority's decision, also employed the, I think, the verb use as it relied on the dictionary definition in large measure
as
well.
The infinitive, to employ, to apply, to carry out, right?
That is correct.
Yeah. Now, how is it used in the, how is it used in the statute?
Well, that's the question for this court to decide, and the real question is, the brass tacks here is, does use mean use in the traditional active verb sense, or does use mean use in possession? And I think that the clear mirror, the plain reading of the statute itself, that being 968.20.1MB, simply means what it says, and that means that somebody has to use the weapon actively.
Well, counsel, use, he has the use of. The is an article modifying use. What does an article modify, a noun or a verb?
It modifies a noun.
Okay, so use in the statute is a noun, is that correct?
In the plain reading of it, yes. If we're going to diagram the sentence like we did in high school, yes, I believe it's the noun.
In the plain reading of the statute, the article, the, modifies the word use, used as a noun. In the plain reading. Now, you're saying that we should do something other than the plain reading. Is that correct?
No, that's not correct. Because
okay.
Even if you use it as a noun in reading 968.20.1MB, you can still say use means use, and that means you have to do something actively, not just possess something. And I think that the majority hit it right on the head in their decision. If the legislature wanted to take guns away from people that were merely possessing them under these circumstances, it could have used the language use or possession, or as the Chief Justice indicated, just the language possession, because that catches everything. But it chose not to do so. I know that there are some high school students here today, and if I could give the court an example, there are probably some young hunters in this courtroom. Let's say one of these young hunters is on a hunting trip with their parent, and on the way back from the hunting trip, they're stopped for speeding or they blow a tire or whatever, and the police happen upon their vehicle, and the father or the mother or the aunt or the uncle or whoever forgot to case the weapon in the back seat. Under Walls, technically, they're violating CCW. They're carrying a concealed weapon. They can meet the statutory elements of that. Did the legislature really want to take a gun away from someone in those circumstances? I don't think so. I think that reading it as the Court of Appeals did and the trial court did is a reasonable way to construe what the legislature wanted to do here, if we at first assume that it's ambiguous. I think the language is not ambiguous. I think the court can look at it clearly on its face, and just because the state and the defendant may disagree as to what it means, it's not necessarily the case that two reasonably well-informed people should disagree. And that's the standard for finding the ambiguity.
Let me compare the facts of this case with your hypothetical. Your defendant had a loaded handgun located between the front seats of the vehicle, according to the criminal complaint, a loaded automatic shotgun, and a rifle, and three knives, ammunition in the vehicle, and a club. What is he doing with all of these weapons?
The record indicates, and I don't know if it was trial counsel, that being me, or Judge Sweetlick, who had put to the defendant the question, why did you have these things? And I believe the record supports his contention that he and his companion that was in the vehicle with him were up here on some type of piecework in a piece of building construction, doing some tiling, I think. And while they were up here, they wanted to do some hunting. And I'm not a hunter, so I can't tell you what is employed in what happens when you go out hunting, but I can assume that you need some type of firearm, maybe a club, I don't know. Maybe if you don't kill the animal completely, I'm not sure. But the gist of his answer to the trial court was that all of these things I had in the car because I thought I could have them. I didn't know it was illegal, even though I erroneously believe that. And the purpose of it was because I was here to do some hunting as kind of a side activity while I was working.
Let's set the scene here. We're in Mequon, for one thing. This is on November 14th, 1998. The gun hunting season doesn't begin until November 21st, according to the internet sources that I have. Well, let me ask this. Why did Mr. Perez have a gun in Florida? Why did he get permission to carry the gun?
If I can discern from what he said in the trial court, to carry a weapon in Florida, you must have a license to do so. and to carry it in a concealed manner. And apparently, as I said, he was a hunter, and in order to transport the vehicle, either on the gun, either in the vehicle or on his person in a concealed way, he had to have permission from that state. He got that permission by way of applying for and having issued the application. We don't have that possibility here in Wisconsin, as far as I know. You simply obtain your hunting license, not necessarily a concealed weapon.
The statute talks about such licenses shall be valid throughout the state for a period of 5 years from the date of issuance. Also says, in for the criteria in issuing to the applicant, desires a legal means to carry a concealed weapon or firearm for lawful self-defense. Now, did Mr. Perez have this for hunting, or did he use it for self-defense?
The trial record simply supports the proposition that he had it for hunting purposes. Now, not part of the record, it's my understanding that Mr. Perez was also a licensed private investigator by the state of Florida.
So he used it for self-defense?
I don't know. I don't know if you have to have a CCW license or a concealed weapon license in Florida to be a private investigator, if that's a prerequisite for issuance of that
now,
license.
When he used it for self-defense, how did he use it?
I don't know. If you're trying to get me to say that merely having it on his person constitutes use, I respectfully disagree with that. And I disagree with that because even if you look to the legislative history here, the Reference Bureau talks about committing a crime with a firearm, and it uses the word firearm. And I don't think that legislative history helps us much in our analysis here, because all it does is it creates a circular argument. You're saying you can't have your weapons back if you committed a crime with a weapon, but how do you commit a crime with a weapon if you haven't used it? So I don't believe that the history helps us at all.
Counsel, are you done with Justice Prosser?
I'm sorry. I find Justice Bradley's, I guess we all got into this, but maybe we'll get some guidance in conference. But it seems to me that it's worthwhile exploring this path of whether it's used as a verb or a noun. As a noun, it seems to me that the word use does not necessarily entail utilization. I have been allowed the use of a firearm. I've been allowed the use of a fishing rod. It doesn't mean that I'm using it. It just... So it seems to me that, but as a verb, I use the fly rod, or it doesn't seem to entail some utilization. Does that help us at all?
Well,
maybe it doesn't help you, but...
I don't think so. In my opinion, that if there is use in any meaning of that word, whether it's used as a noun or a verb or otherwise, there has to be some element of control over, activation of, employment of.
Not necessarily. What about the sentence, John was allowed the use of a fly rod?
Well, that may be a one way of saying possession, but the legislature here didn't say that. They said involving the use. And if, let's use the Chief Justice's example, what if they used the word possession? Then clearly you're on notice that possession is going to cover all uses in all instances of simply possessing it. And by way of Walls, in this case, possession can mean you haven't even touched the weapon. I don't know if I answered your question directly. If I did not, I'll sum it up very quickly and easily, and that is, I believe that the word use or use requires something more than mere possession.
But if I allow someone to use my log home, that's different than if they've used it, right?
I don't think so. Using your log home employs driving into the driveway, walking up the steps, turning down the covers to the bed, opening the refrigerator. I think that something is happening when we think of the word use.
How about if he lets someone have, if they want to come, if they want to come up sometime, You're welcome to the use of my home.
And
the use of my home.
And if the statute says that it has to involve the use, I would say if they didn't go to the home, that they're not subject to its provisions.
When you say the statute, which one are you referring to?
I'm referring to 968-21MB.
Okay. That says the use of, right?
Quote, the involving the use of, end quote.
Let me just raise this. And I think it goes back to something that Attorney Castle said. It seems to me we're retrying here, or attempting to retry, what he's already been found guilty of. And he's been found guilty of carrying a concealed weapon. And you gave us the elements of that. And the element, one element is that the weapon is concealed and in reach. I know that those are fighting words if we were fighting what he was convicted of. But the conviction indicates that he was found having a concealed weapon within his reach, right?
That's correct.
And it doesn't matter, I would suggest, and this is what you should answer, we don't go back and see whether he was hunting, or whether he was fishing, or it was self-defense, or anything else. We just have to look at what are the elements of that crime, at least in this case. Now, maybe in another case, if Mr. Castle's right, it's broader. But at least in this case, the elements of the crime do not require employing the gun. That's been your point.
That is my point.
But do you agree that it's irrelevant whether he's a bad guy carrying a gun because his real goal is to kill somebody, but you can't get him on attempt? You can't get him on conspiracy, so what you can only get him on is carrying a concealed weapon. He may be a bad guy, or he may be a really good guy, and he's just out to hunt, and he did not take appropriate care.
I'm not making that contention. I'm not trying to distinguish Mr. Perez, who is a good guy, from somebody that may not be.
Okay, but under the statute, you're not going to make that distinction.
No, and
the statute doesn't make the distinction.
No, it does not.
Okay.
No, it does not. And I think it's important to remember what Judge Sweetlick said in this case. He did not base his decision on Mr. Perez being a good guy either, I don't think. Now, he may have said, look, he doesn't have a record, he has a license to carry these things, but the specific finding that he made was that Mr. Perez in no way actively employed use of these weapons, and had he done so, I believe I'm quoting him correctly, quote, I certainly would not return these weapons to him, end
okay,
quote.
Now. 939, Justice Presser, do you have a question? Because I was going to go to 939.63, which says if a person commits a crime while possessing, using, or threatening to use a dangerous weapon, maximum term of imprisonment is, and this is an enhancement, if I remember this right. So there they use all three words, possessing, using, and threatening to use. So suppose he had, does it matter to you that in this statute 939.63 you use three words and then none of them are verbs? That here it's just use, is that what you're relying on?
Are you reading subsection 1?
Yep. It also appears in subsection 2.
Okay, subsection 1A of that statute where it says while possessing, using, or threatening to use a dangerous weapon. Well, I would argue that that's a penalty answer separate from the return of property provisions of 968.
I know, but it seems to me you should say that the legislature, if it meant possession, can say possession, and when it means use, it's using a different word.
Such as they did in the penalty enhancement provision that you just
yeah.
cited. Well, that's kind of what I've argued before, and I continue to argue now, that if they wanted to use the word possess, they should have. Mm-hmm. And my guess is that if the Court of Appeals and the trial court are upheld in this decision, they will insert that word. And don't think that under any analysis here that it's unreasonable, that this result is unreasonable or absurd. I think that the legislature, in passing the law as written, has put forth a legitimate societal purpose in getting these guns away from people who use them in the commission of a crime. I don't believe that effort or that intent is thwarted at all by literally meaning, reading this statute to literally mean active use of the weapon. And if the legislature wants to change that so that hunters pulled over for speeding have to forfeit the gun in the back seat of their car, so be it. I don't think that's what they meant to do.
And your position is in the second hearing, which, as indicated, could happen either right away or there could be a later hearing, that the trial judge, could, based on Walls and that definition, that use is not an element of a concealed weapon charge, could, in his or her discretion, make that decision?
I think so, and I think Justice Sykes raised a good point earlier as well. If you analyze this under the terms of strict elements of the crime, you're going to have domestic violence situations where a gun's involved, and if it doesn't meet the element test, you're going to get that gun back. I think the legislature wanted to avoid that exact thing. I think if there's a battery between spouses, and there's a gun in the guy's hand, or a stick in the guy's hand, or something, that the intent is that the police don't give that back and that it be destroyed under the statute. And in this case, and I should...
But where's the discretion? I have sort of missed this discretion. If the in a DV you've got a gun there, or in an armed robbery and there's a gun and it's pointed, you tell me the judge has discretion here to return the property?
In that situation, I think not. I think it says it shall not.
The discretion?
In this, let's use this case as the example,
yeah, okay.
Chief Justice. In this case, Judge Sweetlake had to make a specific finding if there were any employment of the active use of the gun. He had to determine if, as the...
That's a matter of law. The question is, what does that mean under the statute? Use mean in the statute. That's not a discretionary act. It's determining the legal meaning of use.
Well, we have to know what constitutes that. And if, let's say Judge Sweetlake found that upon the officer's approach to the car, the officer observed Mr. Perez take that handgun and put it down in the well of the vehicle. Judge Sweetlake could have very well said, that shows to me that there's... He's trying to conceal it. There he's active furtively in some way with this weapon. That involves the use of the weapon. But where it's just sitting...
If it did, there was no discretion under this, he doesn't return it.
If it involved the use, then the judge shall not return the weapon. That's correct.
So you're going to look beyond the elements and retry the case under this provision.
I think you have to. And if you don't, then you really are getting in, I think, to unreasonable and absurd results when it comes to what the legislature wanted to do with this.
Give me an absurd result.
The absurd result that I was thinking of is the one raised by Justice Sykes, and that is the police come into a battery situation, let's say for proof problems, they can only plead it to a disorderly conduct. And there were guns both ways. Let's say the wife has a crossbow, the husband has a gun, and they're both pointing them at each other. Well, if they plead to a DC, how in the world are you going to forfeit those weapons if we do an elements-only test? There has to be a specific hearing and finding by the trial judge that there was some use of these weapons before the mandate of no return is invoked under 968-20.
Could I ask you, there was ammunition in the van. Was the ammunition used?
If I remember the statute correctly and remember the trial court proceeding correctly, the ammunition by its mere presence resulted in forfeiture. I think that the statute requires that the ammunition not be returned regardless, much like the way contraband is defined.
Well, that's not the way I read the statute. The judge distinguished between the firearms and the ammunition. I think it would be more difficult to argue that the ammunition was used. It was there. It was in the two guns that were loaded, but the circuit judge declined to return the ammunition to Mr. Perez. Did he abuse his authority?
Well, if he did, we didn't challenge it because, quite frankly, we didn't care. If he wanted to keep the bullets, that was fine.
Okay. May I ask you one question? One of the issues the court will have to decide is whether the statute is ambiguous or not, the use of the whole section. Opposing counsel says it's ambiguous, and I think you argue that it isn't ambiguous. Explain why it isn't ambiguous and whether that makes any difference.
Well, I'll answer the second part of your question first. Whether it's ambiguous or unambiguous, I don't think it makes any difference because I think that the court will reach the same result. And that is, if it is ambiguous, it can find that by giving the word use its meaning, such as active employment or something proactive, it doesn't thwart the legislative intent. It doesn't result in unreasonable or absurd results. If it finds that it's unambiguous, obviously it can apply it just as it's written, and that is, use means active use. I think it's unambiguous, and I think I tried to say this before, because, yes, the state and the defense disagree as to what that word means, but should the reasonably well-informed counsel for the state, the reasonably well-informed counsel for the defendant, should we disagree as to its meaning? I don't think so. The state certainly doesn't like the result here, and that's understandable. But it's not an unreasonable result, and it still does not thwart the legislature's intent in passing the law by letting Mr. Perez keep these weapons. So I think either way, if the court finds it's ambiguous or unambiguous, I still think that the decision could favor Mr. Perez.
Mr. Stansford, are you done? Are you finished?
Yes.
Maybe we're looking at the wrong word here, or at least we shouldn't focus solely on use. What about the word involving? By looking at the word involving and defining that, does that give us any lead? Does that get us anywhere?
Well, according to, I think it was Judge Dykeman in the Williams case, in his dissent, he was saying that many times a weapon can be, quote, involved, end quote, in the commission of a crime by its mere presence. And I believe that's exactly what the state's trying to argue today, and that is that simply these guns being in the car involve the use of a weapon. They're involved because they're there. They're mere presence. 968.20 sub 1MB, I think, is that extra step where there has to be a separate analysis of whether or not there was active use of the gun before it can be returned. Involving the use of a weapon under that statute, I still believe, based on the reading of it, I still believe that it requires something more than mere possession. In the Williams case, that weapon was not returned because the defendant therein had been convicted of the crime of recklessly using the weapon. That statute requires physical manipulation of the weapon, active use. Therefore, he shouldn't have gotten it back. In Judge Geske's case in Milwaukee County, the Dyson case, that defendant got the weapons were permitted to be returned because the defendant therein had transferred them to his son, who had not committed any crime and was not a felon and had every legal right to keep them. So I think that it's important to separate the 968 issue from the underlying charge. The 968 issue requires the employment of a separate analysis by the judge as to the facts of that case.
Counsel, first of all, are you finished with that answer? I don't want to interrupt.
Yes.
Okay. Tell me why I'm wrong. And I get back to the verb noun. When used as a verb, the act of using, meaning to suggest the act of using, meaning to employ or make use of. When used as a noun, the use of suggests passive possession with a latent ability to act. Why am I, what is wrong with that?
Well, let's say that use in some instances can mean possession. Under 968.20, I still think it's reasonable to assume that that use has to be something. Let's say that the gun was on his lap or in his pocket or he was holding it on the dash. He was possessing it, but he was possessing it with some element of use, that he had employed some action to it. Here, in Mr. Perez's case, there's nothing to support the fact that those guns hadn't been touched but for a long time before.
I want to be a bit more narrow. That is, I've defined use when it is used as a verb, and I've defined it when it is used as a noun. What's wrong with those definitions?
I don't think that there's anything wrong with the definitions.
Well, let me make, I want to make sure, because I don't want in any way to for you to misspeak. As a noun, as in the use of, suggests passive possession with a latent ability to act. And are you agreeing with that or not?
Well, I understand what you're saying, but I don't think that it necessarily means that under 968.20, I don't think that it means under 968.20 that merely having them in your physical vicinity, these weapons, means that you've used them. I disagree with that proposition. And I think that the case law, and I think that what little legislative intent we have here supports the proposition that the legislature contemplated some active use of the firearm or weapon at issue. And
I just want to go back to Justice Cross's question. It seems to me that we have to utilize the word use in the same way when we talk about dangerous weapon or we talk about ammunition. And so, when we talk about ammunition here, and then the next sentence is the property may be returned, referring to either the dangerous weapon or the ammunition, how do we have here, and I know you didn't object, but as a theoretical matter of interpreting the statute, how do you interpret use ammunition?
Two ways. The first way is obviously using it by firing the firearm. Secondly, using the ammunition may be that if you have employed some exercise of control over the weapons, holding it, having it on your lap, having it on the dashboard with your hand on it, and it's loaded, that may very well be the case that the ammunition, as a byproduct of being in the weapon, is therefore put into use as well and would have to be forfeited under the statute. So I think it's reconcilable under the facts of this case to still say that even though the ammunition may not have been used, that it's okay still to say that it had not been used, even though we didn't object to not having it returned.
Is carrying just ammunition without guns, is that carrying a concealed weapon?
I don't believe so. I don't think ammunition
falls. Is there a crime of carrying ammunition?
I'm not sure if there is or not. I don't think that it meets the definition of dangerous weapon under the CCW statute or jury instruction, but I'm not positive of that. I don't know if there's a separate crime for just carrying ammunition.
Okay.
I think probably the legislature was contemplating guns that have ammunition in them. I don't know that for sure, but in this case, Judge Sweetlick said, I'm not giving you back any ammunition, period, and that was fine. We as I said, did not object.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Castle.
I want to start by clarifying a factual question that I think makes no difference to the outcome of the case, but since Justice Prosser, you were raising the issue of what was he doing with these guns? I think the answer is, in this record, we don't know anything about what he's doing with the guns. At the sentencing hearing, Judge Sweetlick said, what's the purpose for his having that license? Mr. Stansbury said, I believe for hunting, is that right? Mr. Perez, is that why you have the concealed weapon license in Florida? Mr. Perez said, yes, sir. At the hearing on the motion, Mr. Stansbury said, I think he said at the sentencing that he was going to use his guns for hunting. But in fact, we know nothing about why they were here. But I don't think it matters. But I just want to make that clear. We've heard some talk about absurd results. I think we can each paint our picture of absurd results. Let me paint for you the person who sticks, an 18-year-old has a new pistol he's very proud of. He sticks it in his waistband. He's got a coat over it. It's concealed. He takes it to school. It's spotted by a security guard when the waistband blows open. He has committed two misdemeanors. He has possessed a gun in the school zone. He has carried a concealed weapon. He has not, in Mr. Sandberg's words, actively employed the gun. He was just walking around tucked in his waistband. Under the analysis employed, I believe, by the Court of Appeals and urged by the defendant, that defendant, after being convicted of carrying a concealed weapon, of possession of a gun in the school zone, and perhaps disorderly conduct, but that's another case, would be entitled to the return of that gun that he has carried into the school zone. I don't think the legislature necessarily intended that result.
Why didn't the legislature just say a crime involving a dangerous weapon, if that's what it meant?
Well,
or a crime with a dangerous weapon. Anyone who commits a crime involving a dangerous weapon, or anyone who commits a crime with a dangerous weapon. Why did they put in the use of, if it doesn't mean anything?
I don't have an answer other for the specific choice of language, other than to say a legislator looking at the LRB analysis might well think that that's exactly.
So this is one of those situations where the legislature thought they were doing one thing but actually did another by the language that it employed?
Well, I think the language is broad enough to encompass that. I hate to go back to the noun-verb distinction, because I will completely confess that I had not given any thought to that distinction ahead of time, perhaps in part because the Court of Appeals looked at this as a verb. But Justice Bradley, you said in the noun sense of the of use as passive possession with a latent ability to act. I think that's a verb sense too. If I gave an example in my reply brief, if I'm a pizza delivery driver driving around late at night, I've got a gun under my seat. I'm using that gun to protect myself. I am passively possessing it with the latent ability to act. I think even in the verb sense, it applies. So I think use is broad enough to encompass all these situations, and that's why I think we got to look at what the legislature was trying to accomplish. So no further questions.
I don't think you want to leave the impression that pizza drivers can have loaded weapons under their seats.
No, that is the crime of carrying a concealed weapon, and I think that this court last term in Dundon addressed a case in which there was an entirely innocent purpose. We had the poor gas station manager who was begging the armored car company to come pick up the receipts because the safe was overflowing. After 3 days, when the armored car didn't come, he needed to get the receipts to the bank. He tucked the gun in his waistband. And the trial court there, not only was he convicted, this defendant got 45 days in jail, and this court said no evidence this person was a bad person. There's ample evidence he committed a crime. And so, no, I'm not suggesting that the pizza driver, even if he doesn't know he's breaking the law, even if he's not intending to commit a crime, that is not a crime.
But there is a constitutional right in this state to use a weapon for security and defense.
Correct. We have not had seen that raised in this case at all. And I can tell you that there are percolating in the lower courts of the state issues whether the CCW law is constitutional, given that constitutional amendment. I can also say that in other states with similar constitutional provisions, the courts have said that that does not prohibit the legislature from enacting reasonable regulations in the exercise of its police power.
Isn't there a safety statute that specifies the way that you can safely transport a weapon in a vehicle, and it specifically says it's got to be cased and unloaded?
Correct.
So that, at least with regard to the weapon that was cased and unloaded in this case, he could not have been convicted of CCW for that offense, and that weapon has to go back?
I don't think that's the case. I think if it's still within reach, I think there is case law that says, though I think that's 16171, doesn't trump the CCW statute.
Do you remember what case that is?
Off the top of my head, I don't remember.
Well, that raises a question which I've been trying to get at. Can we retry that guilty plea?
Even if that
was not a dangerous weapon under 93910, and the conviction was invalid, he has been now convicted of carrying a concealed weapon. When he wants that weapon back, can he retry it and say, hey, it's not a concealed weapon, it's okay to carry it and without a case, and right up against me? And
No, he can't. And I think that would be the appropriate second part of the answer to your question, is that by pleading guilty, he has waived any argument.
And he's not opening that. I mean, he has an opportunity to open the conviction and say, facts don't substantiate my guilty plea, and that's another case.
This case.
Here you have to assume the conviction.
We assume a valid conviction because the complaint charged all three. We assume a valid conviction on all three. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Castle. Thank you, Mr. Sansbury. We are in recess to 1:45. Classes, including the class that's or classes upstairs, will meet with Justice Wilcox. And anyone else who would like to stay and hear that discussion, cordially invited. This case teaches you that